Good afternoon. You're listening to Praxis on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. I'm really happy to be joined in the studio today, finally, after a long time of hoping to talk on the show by Larry Shook. He's a veteran journalist and a veteran of war with PTSD. He works to raise awareness about PTSD in the community in his writing and speaking and working with other vets. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Taylor. Thanks for having me.
And today is Valentine's Day, so it while it might not seem like it on the surface, I think it will be a love-themed show on some level, but probably on the broad level. I think it's safe to say, you know, how can we replace this violent culture that we have with something that's more human and about love and connection and all those things. So I hope you're on board for that.
Absolutely.
Good. So could you... just really briefly to ground people in your story, how did you come to understand, work on your own PTSD and begin to communicate about PTSD with other people?
I think like most combat veterans, I came back from war with a deep malaise and discomfort and so forth. I knew from the beginning that there was something really wrong, but there was no help in addressing it, no explanation. And so over the years, I just buried it, and I just, to the best of my ability. And I partially consciously, but I think mostly subconsciously, developed a strategy for dealing with these very sad memories, very sad, violent memories that were always with me. And I became a very good actor. And many people who have known me did not know that I was in Vietnam. And when people learned that I was a door gunner on a gunship, they couldn't believe it because I'm such a mild-mannered person. And it reflected the extent to which I buried that experience. In 2012, well, back up a little bit, I was persuaded by several of my old buddies to finally attend a reunion of our old gunship platoon in 2006 after all those years. And I didn't want to. I resisted it for a long time, even though I love those guys. I'm closer to those guys in a way than I am to any other human being. But getting together with them and sitting around and drinking beer and remembering these terrible things is the last thing in the world I wanted to do. And nevertheless, I learned that my old platoon leader, Captain Harry Gawkowski, was going to be there. And he was a person that I had enormous admiration for. I attended the reunion. It was wonderful to see those guys. And my nightmare came true. I came home from that reunion, started having memories that I really couldn't manage very well, causing depression and so forth. I did some therapy called eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy that let me keep going. In 2012, I hit a deer with my car in the dark, and it triggered a massive Vietnam flashback. And in the morning, I was just overwhelmed with these memories, and I couldn't manage them. And so from that time forward, I've just been working real hard on dealing with my PTSD.
And you talk about part of that, I think, part of my introduction to you and your story was to watch the video that was produced of a kind of a guest sermon, a talk that you gave at the Unitarian Universalist Church about that incident with the deer, about your whole journey. And you talk there about... something I want to kind of kick off with as far as understanding PTSD. You talk about a book called War in the Soul, and I hear you talk a lot when you speak about PTSD as a soul wound. So in two parts, what do you think the soul is? Because that's a broad part of it that we need to understand. And what do you mean when you say that it's a soul wound? And what might neurologists say is happening?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Yeah,
Taylor. When I call it a soul wound, I'm just parroting Dr. Tick, and I'm parroting others, you know, clinical psychologists who use that phrase. It'd be really nice if we could get an x-ray of the soul so that we had a handy definition. It just resonates with me. It's a profound wound of the psyche, your sense of who you are, your sense of what the world is, your sense of place in it. And, you know, Dr. Tick says that PTSD is not a psychological disorder, it's a soul wound. That's the way he defines it. And he's generally recognized as being one of the world's foremost authorities on it. So that comes as close as anything I know to describing what I experience. And, you know, they say that, well, I'm not going to go further. I just want to answer your questions. Is that,
yeah,
handle it?
And I think kind of a bridge to that, that you've also described to me, and another phrase that you've used that I think may also be Dr. Tick's, is a psycho-spiritual death.
Right.
And I don't know if you can describe, you've spoken with me before about kind of that you felt that process in war, and then maybe we can talk about what neurologists might say that process was that you were perceiving as a 18-year-old young man.
Right. So, you know, my understanding of PTSD based on my research and based on my personal experience is that what happens is typically you go into the military as a young person. I went in when I was 20 years old. And at that time, psychologically, your adult identity is not formed. You've just completed your adolescence. You've got a handle on who you were as an adolescent. You know that you're at the cusp of adulthood, and now you've got to figure out how to make your way in the adult world, how to balance checkbooks and, you know, pay insurance and all that kind of stuff. And at that moment, you're taken into the military, and you are given no choice about your conduct. You have to obey. You have to do what you're told to do, or you'll go to jail. You forfeit your life, basically. They you can be put in federal penitentiary. When you're discharged, it's with a dishonorable discharge, so that's going to really compromise your career opportunities, et cetera, et cetera. So here you are, a young person. They say, do this, and they give you training about how to kill. And that's a very, very difficult taboo to overcome. It's the most difficult taboo to overcome for most people. But they've developed the training that allows them to do that. And then you go to war, and you experience the violence of war, and you experience all the tragedy of war and so forth. But you also experience yourself killing. And that violates this taboo that I think is actually recorded in our DNA. You're doing something that you know in the deepest part of your being is wrong. And it's darn sure wrong in comparison to the way you were raised. My mother did not raise me to be a killer. Mm-hmm. My mother did not raise me to do the things that I did in war. And so there's a tremendous disconnect. It's like a wedge gets driven into your understanding of who you are and who the world, what the world is. And then I think that's the psycho-spiritual death that Dr. Tick refers to. Your sense of self-respect as a decent human being is lost, because you behaved in a way that is not decent. War is murder. It's murder. And if you do it, you know that that's what you're doing. And in most of the time in war, when you murder, you're doing it for a simple reason: to keep yourself from being murdered. You're doing it to save your life. And you do it in a context of incredible emotional intensity. I don't know of any words that can describe the emotional intensity of combat, knowing that the next second you may be dead, the next second you may be dead, etc. It really overwhelms your perceptual powers, your cognitive mechanism, and all of that. And then in the aftermath of it, you try to make sense of it. And that creates a rift between who you thought you were, what you thought the world was, what you thought your society was? How could my society have sent me to do these things? What kind of a society do I live in? And so the death is the understanding of all those things that you had before that, you know, that experience. There's another component they talk about. They say that there are three elements of PTSD: the trauma of war, the trauma of seeing people die, and what they call moral injury. And that's a fairly new psychological understanding. And the simple definition of moral injury is betrayal of what's right. Hmm. We're raised to know what's right and wrong. And the 98% of us who don't have antisocial personality disorder mm-hmm. know what's right and wrong. We wind up doing what we know is wrong. We now have to live with that.
Hmm. And that's, so part of this, I'm going to share a little bit of a piece you sent me by Loana Hoylman talking about Reed Lyon, who is a Vietnam vet also, who is a neurologist who's done a lot of neurological research. And the piece is called PTSD in Our Reptilian Brain. And I'm just going to read a small chunk of it that we can talk a little bit about how it plays out. He talks about, well, I'll just read from the beginning of this section. Although a single instance of overwhelming terror can alter the chemistry of the brain, making people more sensitive to adrenaline surges even decades later, developing PTSD from one incident is rare. But if trauma happens over and over, even if each event is not catastrophic, a person is likely to get PTSD. The brain and the body do not get to rest and recuperate between times of high alert and terror. Hypervigilance becomes a constant even when no danger is actually present. Hypervigilance alone makes life unpleasant and sometimes terrible, constantly holding ready for the disaster that is around every corner. So this constant state of arousal, in this constant state of arousal, anger comes easily and without warning. And I'm going to skip forward. So she talks about, and the research talks about, how the brain adapts to the ongoing dangerous situation of war, and how that there isn't an off switch for that, basically. She says, in a dangerous situation, we have little or no control over what happens in our brains. In the reptilian brain, otherwise known as the limbic system, many areas are stimulated, alerted, and activated simultaneously and instantly. The limbic system includes the hippocampus, amygdala, and hypothalamus. This is the seat of our emotions in the brain. Here also is behavior, motivation, and long-term memory. It's where memory begins. So she goes on to talk about how all of these areas of the brain basically shrink in a defense response to this constant stimulation. And maybe I can have you pick up, do they grow back again is the question. You know, how does that cycle end? And that's kind of the root from what I've read, and I think from what you've shared with me, neurologically, the root of the issue with PTSD and understanding it is how do we unstimulate those parts of the brain?
Right. Right. And my understanding is that they don't grow back. It's a permanent physical alteration of the brain, the actual tissue of the brain, and the neurochemistry of the brain. The hopeful thing is that the brain is infinitely neuroplastic. The brain can change infinitely. But that requires practice. Every time we do something, the brain is changing. When we learn something, the brain is changing. The tragedy in our society today is that while the military now understands, and while medicine now understands, that if you send people to combat, as we continue to do, you're going to change them forever. If they lose an arm or a leg, we can give them real fancy high-tech mm-hmm. prosthetics. But the damage that's done to the brain requires a different kind of remediation, and the government's not doing that yet. And that's what's so tragic, and that's where the fire in my belly comes from, to help young people. Mm-hmm. That help was not available for my generation. And it largely still isn't. And what's happening with a lot of guys my age, Vietnam vets, is that we say, we're not going to stand by. Mm-hmm. We know what happens. And, you know, one of the things that happens to you when you're in the military is that you do develop a bond that almost defies comprehension. When you, in war, all you have are your colleagues. That's it. You don't have the, quote, military. You don't have society. You don't have the government. All you have is each other. And there's a neurotransmitter known as vasopressin that brings up, that is about extreme protectiveness. It triggers also that kind of intense stress, trigger stimulation of the neurotransmitter oxytocin, which is about bonding. That's where bonding comes from. That's what enables mothers to bond so deeply with their babies, to enjoy nursing, to give their life over to their baby. There's a chemical basis for that. Mm-hmm. That same thing operates in war. That's one reason that men have, I think, it's one reason that men have the love of war that they do, because they experience a kind of bonding and they experience a kind of loving that we don't in our culture. Mm-hmm. It's very that changes you. And so one of the things that's happening in my generation is that those bonds that were first instilled in the military are now kicking in a new way.
Mm-hmm. Kind of seeing history repeat itself in so many ways, you mean, and feeling that affinity for this new generation of vets.
Yes. For example, there is an agency that's associated with the VA known as the Vet Centers, but it's not the VA. And it was created by Vietnam veterans. And Vietnam mm-hmm. veterans said, we want an agency that represents us. The VA does not represent us. You're abandoning us. And all this stuff that you think you're doing to help with PTSD, these drugs and so forth that you're giving us, that doesn't do it. And these representatives of the VA that you have us dealing with simply don't understand what we're dealing with. So we want an agency that's staffed by combat veterans that know what it is to deal with this. That's where the vet centers came from. And I think, I know all over the country today, one of the real powerful grassroots responses to help deal with PTSD comes from veterans.
Which makes a lot of sense, I mean, in many ways. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS, talking with Larry Shook about PTSD, what it is, literally, so far, and how we can address it societally on an individual level and the rest. And that's a perfect segue. You mentioning the VA, mentioning medication. I think that's the popular response. That's kind of where we are in medicine across the board. And with psychiatric treatment tends to be to medicate folks. Can you talk a little bit about that, what the pluses and minuses might be? And what other kinds of treatment there are out there for people with PTSD?
I want to be really careful to not step outside the bonds of what I know. The plus side of medication is that if somebody is so distraught, they're about to take their life, or they're about to become violent with somebody else. If there's a medication that will moderate that behavior and keep them alive and keep them from harming others, that's good. The medication itself, however, is not capable of healing the underlying condition. So to just medicate without a very effective therapy to alter the underlying condition is just a formula for addiction and disruption of the body's natural processes. That's what happens. Medication would not be an option for me because I abhor it. I hate drugs, and I just wouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. I'll do anything to take my chances managing the stress rather than put a foreign substance in my body. Meditation is a very effective form of therapy. Psychotherapy, if you can get a good psychotherapist, is very effective because that that is creating brain changes that are, you know, literally building new structures around the trauma, you know, giving you a new skill set. Mm-hmm. One of the things that happens with PTSD is that the emotional centers of the brain, as you mentioned earlier, are altered. They're permanently changed. And one of the consequences of that is that it causes you to lose your will to live. And that goes, I think that goes a long way to explaining this terrible epidemic of suicides we have. We're losing about 8,500 veterans and active duty military personnel a year now. That's 5 times more deaths than we had in the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, which was the bloodiest battle of the war. I fought in it. I was in Tet. I know how crazy and intense and insane it was, mm-hmm. and how dangerous it was. I mean, it was just so dangerous. And the idea that we are sustaining 5 times that number of casualties every year from people who take their own lives shows you what the consequence is of, quote, losing the will to live. How do you reconnect with that? How do you find the will to live again? It does require very effective therapy. And what we're dealing with now, Taylor, is that most of us, we're basically on our own. It's like you got to find your way. And so I would hope that 5 years from now, we'll have a much better map available to help people find their way. But right now, those of us with PTSD, we reach out to each other. What's been just hugely helpful to me is my best Army friend. He and I were like brothers in the Army, and we roomed together in the gun platoon. And when I and Hugh Scanlon's his name, Hugh was hit by his PTSD crisis 20 years after Vietnam, mm-hmm. and it was the same triggering event. He had an automobile accident. And it just flushed these memories. Hugh was a very successful broadcast journalist. He was managing a television station in Sacramento. He became suicidal. I mean, gun in his mouth, sitting on the bridge, thinking of jumping off. That's what losing the will to live means. Hugh actually feels that he was saved by a fluke. He was sitting on the bridge. He was just in so much pain. It's like life is not worth living. It's why be alive if it's only about pain, if it's only about suffering, if it's only about fear, et cetera. People take it as long as they can, and then they check out. Hugh is in that position, and he's sitting there on the bridge thinking about jumping. And Hugh's a huge guy. He's built like an NFL lineman. And the thing that kept him from jumping, I mean, the thing that he had a 38 in his mouth. The thing that kept him from pulling the trigger was he's a real sweet guy. His nickname was Sugar Bear in Vietnam. He didn't want his landlady to have to clean up the mess. And so he's like, he wasn't going to traumatize somebody else. And he thought, okay, I know this real busy overpass on I-5. I'll just go jump off. So he's sitting on this overpass, looking down through his boots, and he realizes if I jump and I land on top of a car, I'm going to kill everybody in the car. And it's like he thought, I don't know what to do here. And at that moment, he heard a voice, and the voice said, there are 58,000 names on that wall. Every one of them would like to be in your position. You can't take your life. And that's what changed Hugh's life. And he spent a year of really intense, really hard therapy, saved his bacon. And then he got training to help other people with PTSD. Mm. Well, when I was hit with my crisis, I could roll over and dial Hugh. And I said, dude, this is what's happening. He said, it's your PTSD, man. You got to deal with it. You got to get through it. Yeah, but how? And he talked me through it. Since I hit that deer in 2012, Hugh and I have had thousands of conversations. I can call him at 3 o'clock in the morning. And he's always there. That's one of the most important things that those of us with PTSD can do, to reach out to others who have it and, you know, can continue to come back. there has to be a way to be more methodical about helping people with PTSD put together that kind of strategy for themselves. If you don't, then they are going to drink, they are going to drug, they're going to, you know, if I get a headache, I take aspirin. I don't like the pain. If the pain of PTSD is too much to live with, and people deal with it as best they can to end that pain. And some of those ways result in tragedy. There has to be a better way to help people deal with it than we're doing right now.
Mm-hmm. It seems that the main approach, or a major approach that's being taken, is this idea of, you know, take the drugs, they'll help, and you'll move on. You know, things will go back to normal eventually, I think is the message that's still being sent, you know, despite the evidence of guys like you and like Hugh, who 20 years later, it hasn't gone away, telling these younger guys coming back now that, you know, things will go back to normal, sending that message through films and just pop culture in general, which we can talk about a little bit later. But I think that, coupled with the idea of drug therapy and tripled with the kind of machismo we have in the culture of, there's still a big stigma, I think, for men especially, about opening up and being vulnerable, that it creates this cocktail. And I want to share a little bit. This piece that you shared with me was really surprising. This is a topic I'm familiar with. I like to follow all the fallout from the wars, if you can even call them that at this point. And this piece is from the Austin American Statesman, and it is by a whole investigative team, actually. I'll share it in the podcast notes, which you can find by going to kyrs.org. If you're listening to this later on, I'll post this because it's a very interesting year-long investigation that they did in the state of Texas. They went through death records provided by the VA, but also beyond that, because for many reasons that they detail in the study, the VA doesn't keep very complete numbers on this. And they found that in addition to the very straightforward cases of suicide among vets and active duty military, that there were this other set of deaths that are somewhat related to the drug treatment. And I'll just read from the study. The investigation found that more than one in three died from a drug overdose, a fatal combination of drugs or suicide. Their median age at death was 28. Nearly one in five died in a motor vehicle crash, many of those being single vehicle crashes. Of those with a primary diagnosis of PTSD, the numbers are even more disturbing. 80% died of overdose, suicide, or a single vehicle crash. Only two of the 46 Texas veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan operations who had a PTSD diagnosis died of disease or illness. The 345 Texas veterans identified by the VA as having died since coming home is equal to nearly two-thirds of the state's casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan. But that only includes veterans who have sought VA benefits, meaning the total number of deaths is likely much larger. So they looked at it and saw that many of these overdoses were not the traditional intentional overdose. What does that say, do you think? And is that a problem with drugs, or is it a problem with misunderstanding the science of PTSD, or what is going on?
I think it's both, and I think understanding the science of PTSD is something that we're still quite a ways away from. And it's going to take a very rigorous scholarly effort to understand it. And are we going to mount that effort? That's a really big question. As I came to understand PTSD, a question that occurred to me was, if you understand that a disease results from a particular kind of risky behavior, say getting AIDS, then the advice is avoid the behavior that puts you at risk for getting AIDS, right? Mm-hmm. Well, the behavior that causes PTSD is war. Humanity does not know how to conduct its affairs without war. War is a very, very bad habit. We don't know. Humanity literally does not know how to live without war. And war comes from our collective terror. If we don't protect ourselves, you know, then we're at risk, et cetera, et cetera. And so asking humanity to really understand the connection between war and this devastating ailment that we call PTSD is in and of itself challenging. It's not particularly challenging to ask society to understand what behavior to avoid AIDS. It is challenging to ask society to understand what behavior to avoid PTSD. You know, the other part of your question, is it a misunderstanding of the drugs? I think it is. I will tell you that anecdotally and in my research, what I've learned is that many of the vets who are being prescribed drugs and are told to take the drugs stop taking them because of the impact that it has on them. And so they understand that you can't just dump these pills in the environment because they're toxic. And they're conscientious. They don't want to just flush them down the toilet and put that stuff in the watershed and so forth. Mm-hmm. And they come up with really innovative ways to dispose of the drugs. Digging a hole in the ground, lining it with ReadyCrete, with cement, filling it with the pills, and when that hole is filled, capping it with cement. I've heard stories of people putting all of their pills in a plastic bucket, and when the bucket got full, pouring water in and it creating a chemical reaction that caused the plastic of the bucket to melt and the effluent to spill out over the ground. I have a good friend who was prescribed a VA medication, who was driving in the mountains, high in the mountains, with switchback turns and drop-offs on the edge. And he realized he heard his tires squealing, and he couldn't understand why his tires were squealing. And he looked at his speedometer, and he was going a lot faster than he realized he was going. It really scared him. He was going way over the speed limit. So he would slow down and do the speed limit, but he would immediately start to speed again because of the effect of the drug. Mm. The only way he could drive safely was to keep his eye on the speedometer. If he didn't keep his eye on the speedometer, he would just start speeding. And to drive safely on the road and keep his eye on the speedometer, he had to move at a crawl. That was the effect of the drug. He stopped taking that drug. My understanding is the other thing that happens with those drugs is they're not precise at all the way they can be prescribed because they behave differently in every organism. So you say to the doctor, I'm having, you know, some anxiety and, you know, here are my symptoms. And the doctor says, well, here's a pill that'll handle that. Try that. I'm going to put you, how much do you weigh? I'm going to put you on that dose. And then they just adjust. No, still anxious, doc. Still not sleeping well. Okay, we'll up it. And they try to fine tune it. Once they do get it fine tuned and they get the behavioral modification they want, the organism starts changing. It's not static. And so as you're putting those external chemicals into the body, it's changing the body's chemistry. I compare treating PTSD with drugs to treating Ebola with bloodletting. It's just primitive. It's a primitive, brutal form of medicine.
And what kind of what level of success have you had? I know you mentioned meditation specifically. What about an approach like that? I've talked to quite a few vets who manage some of their symptoms and just manage their lives through exercise. I know a lot of runners who are veterans and swimmers and things like this. What about those activities do you think is effective? What's the promise of that?
I think it's very promising. I think that's the direction in which the solution lies. Working with Mother Nature, working with the pharmacy that exists in your body. They talk about the need to practice, if you have PTSD, they talk about the need to practice good mental hygiene for PTSD. And what does that include? It certainly includes a healthy lifestyle, putting good nutrients in the body so that the body can be as healthy and strong as possible. It absolutely includes staying physically fit. Mm-hmm. It includes getting air, you know, getting endorphins, et cetera, et cetera. Those things have a huge effect on me. If I go for a few days without getting my endorphin hit, I feel it. Another really important thing is to practice good sleep hygiene. That's very challenging. That's really tricky for me. Hmm. I don't sleep very well for the most part, and I'm on 60% PTSD benefits now, and that relieves some of my financial pressure. That allows me to take naps during the day, and that allows me to write. I couldn't manage my sleep loss, the sleep loss that I experience now. I couldn't manage it with caffeine. It just wouldn't work. I need to sleep when I need to sleep. And so now, if I wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, instead of panicking, I'll be present to the memory. Okay, I'm having this memory. That's fine. It's not happening right now. Mm-hmm. There's nothing. No, there are no rockets falling outside. Mm-hmm. I've got my reading right there on the bed. I turn the light on. I do my reading. I read myself back to sleep. Mm-hmm. I've had disrupted sleep, but I can nap during the day. That's my particular hygienic approach. That's really challenging for people who have to work a 40-hour mm-hmm. week. Really challenging.
Yeah, it is. But that's, so basically the approach seems to be getting your chemicals, making them yourself, right? Kind of a homespun, find out how to brew your own chemicals, what works for you, and take those, which is then strengthening the brain, right? I mean, to the extent that we know, to re-stimulate the hippocampus, the amygdala, the hypothalamus. Yes, I'm learning. to figure that out ourselves rather than do it with drugs that are not going to have a constant
effect on us. Let me let Dr. Shook prescribe. Here's my prescription. First of all, if you have PTSD, understand that not only are you not crazy, you're a good person. Because you've got grief and sadness about being part of something that's really sad. And humanity does not know at this moment how not to send its young to war. If you get sent to war, chances are you're going to have very, very sad memories to deal with for the rest of your life. Doesn't make you weak. Doesn't make you crazy. It makes you normal. It shows that you're a healthy, decent, loving human being who wants to do good in the world. So understand that. Number two, understand that you're not alone. You feel alone because the message you get from the culture is, well, and particularly if you're a guy, if you're a stud, if you're tough, you deal with this. Shake it off. Get on with it. Horrible, horrible message. And understand that everybody who is normal, and 98% of us are normal, deal with this kind of grief. Mm-hmm. So those are my first two prescriptions. Number three, figure out what you love. If it's fishing, if it's hiking, if it's horses, that's my passion right now. If it's knitting, if it's painting, whatever it is, whatever connects you to the beauty and joy of life, do that. Make a space in your life to do that. And only you know that. Number four, you know, reach for help. Look for help. If you can do therapy and you can find yourself a good therapist, for God's sake, do that. That is so helpful. Meditation, I absolutely believe in. It's not complicated. I mean, take 10 minutes a day, close your eyes, and breathe. That'll do it. Hmm. Practice yoga. I mean, it's not one thing. There's not a pill you can take. I mean, it's fortunate that the name of your program is practice. It's a practice that's required mm-hmm. to deal with that.
So we've mentioned the culture a couple times, and before we dive into that, I'll remind everyone that you're listening to KYRS. You're listening to Conversation on Praxis with Larry Shook, talking about PTSD, talking about soon the culture we're in and how to maybe address and subvert that aspect of it, perhaps the most difficult portion of what we're dealing with here. If you missed the beginning of this conversation and you'd like to hear the full hour, the podcast is available at praxisradio509.podomatic.com. If that's too long to remember, just find Praxis on kyrs.org, and there's a full list with links there for you. So I am going to share a little bit of something you said that hopefully you remember saying. I think you will. In your piece, Grace and Me, that you shared with the Unitarian Church, you talk about these men who you met in Vietnam, who you formed these lifelong bonds with, and you said that they meant to give their lives for the cause of freedom, that is true, that was their true belief. It's what they were told by their country, the adults around them. You know, at 18, are you an adult? It's debatable. But it's also true, you said, that I took part in the murder of an innocent people and the destruction of their home, and that the grief and shame at that evil you took part in is almost unbearable. But then you go on to say that the surrounding madness in a society that's so absolute, the madness in a society so absolute that would say that that kind of destruction is normal, was the most difficult part to grapple with. And we talked about that at the beginning of the hour. You also tell a story about being 12 and being hired by your grandpa to go out and shoot sparrows who were eating his strawberries, and that you couldn't do it, which is, it's a beautiful story. And then you reflect that 8 years later, you're in this criminal war, killing people as your job, and you say, you know, how did this happen? And you said, this is what I really liked, and I'd like to talk about this with you. You said, I was culturally and hereditarily programmed to be a killer. I was brainwashed, in other words, I was catechized in the violent American madrasa of empire. I really like that line. but I also just, how does that programming happen? I mean, that's something that this entire show has been focused on for 3 years. But how does that programming happen, and why? And how do you think we can undo some of it? How can we reprogram an entire society that's been so violent for so long?
Well, thanks, Taylor. That's an easy question.
Sorry. Yeah. We don't have to answer it all today.
Well, you know, I need to observe that one of the ways I have distracted myself from dealing with the terror inside me of having participated in war is to try to change the world, try to save the world. And people who know me well are very familiar with my intensity, and it's been troubling to people sometimes. And some of my efforts, as I look back on them, were unrealistic. I was desperate to change the world. And what I realize now is that's absurd. That's all I can do is change myself. And that's why I'm doing this program. That's why I did that sermon. I think it's really important that we give ourselves permission to feel our feelings. We don't need cultural permission to do that. And that we then speak our truth. And I do think consciousness is rapidly changing now. Is it changing fast enough? Well, I don't know, but I do think it's rapidly changing. And I see that in the PTSD movement. One of the most important things we can do, I think, is find the courage to speak out, and it's not easy. It does take courage to do it, but if we don't do it, we leave the trauma of PTSD inside us. It's like a cancer. It just festers, and it disrupts every part of your life. And so to be able to speak out requires a safe container. It requires that, you know, you get guidance and so forth. But that's happening in the PTSD community. I'd like to share a little example, if I could. So when I went to my first PTSD retreat, it was very empowering to me to hear other veterans just describe their experience, how lonely they feel, the terror that you feel. You feel terror because you think, I'm so badly damaged, I just can't fit in. Nobody's going to want me in their lives. I can't fit in this society. It's very, very frightening. For me, way more frightening than the violence of war. Hmm. War was a piece of cake compared to that terror. So it was very illuminating for me to sit around with other veterans and realize that they had the same experience that I had. The experience that I heard that absolutely shocked me was the description of military sexual trauma. It was just unbelievable that our society has allowed a culture that permits the systematic abuse of people in the military. But what's happening is people are finding the courage to step forward. It's very, very hard for women. Mm-hmm. It's very hard for men too. Men face almost as much sexual abuse in the military as women do. It's very hard for a woman to speak out because it's like the culture is against her. It's like, you know, if it mattered to our culture that women are treated the way they are, they wouldn't be treated that way. So it's very hard for women to find the courage to speak out about it. It's really hard for men to find the courage to speak out about it because you're supposed to be strong enough that you can take care of yourself. What I have experienced in these retreats is people stepping forward and telling their truth. And that in itself is profoundly healing. And I do believe that every time any one of us heals even a little bit, it contributes to the collective healing.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I tend to focus to a fault on the bad things because they jump out at me and they just tear me apart, you know, just seeing the warmongering that happens in the culture and all of that. I tend to go straight to rage mode, and it's good to hear that from people who have been through the worst of the ringer of this culture. I have a theory that I'm going to bounce to you and see what you think. It sounds like that from what you've said and from a lot of the reading I've done, that vets themselves, particularly with PTSD, once they have a safe container, as you said, will be the first to acknowledge that it's a problem and that something has been done to them. I think a lot of the holdup in the broader change comes from people who haven't been directly exposed to it, but who are still deeply conditioned by these ideas we have. So you see the huge success of, you know, American Sniper, this Clint Eastwood movie, which is really pretty jingoistic, you know, racist tale, because it's a tale. It's not true in most approximations of the word, you know, look at Iraq and Afghanistan. You have all of this coming out, and it seems that many of the people who defend it will, you know, under the rallying cry of support our troops, be the first to keep it going. And we've talked a little bit about this, but I think that we're in a point in history that is bizarre and intense, and everyone is kind of has been lightly traumatized by living in this military empire. How do you think you can start to broach that conversation with people who aren't on the front end of it, and just start having a more honest examination of what we're doing culturally with people who haven't seen the extreme, ugly end point of what they're advocating?
Right. I think that too is a great question, and I think the answer is difficult. You know, the challenge is that only 1/10 of 1% of the public has experienced combat. That's our largest financial expenditure. The military is our largest financial expenditure by far. It's, you know, our military conduct is endowed by the public. But only 0.1% of the public that's paying for war, that's paying for, you know, the foreign policy that sends us to war so precipitously, understands the actual concept, consequence of being in combat. So that's a very challenging dialogue to have happen. If you have PTSD, it's very challenging to talk about it. It's very challenging to understand it. By definition, what trauma is a life-threatening event that exceeds the psyche's normal ability to make meaning of it, that exceeds our normal cognitive capacity. And that's particularly the case if it's chronic trauma, like day after day. If you pull out of a stop sign and somebody broadsides you and you get hurt and so forth, the brain's going to be changed, but it's going to be traumatically changed by stress, not just the physical impact. But as the clinicians say, that'll come back in a pretty short period of time. But if you had that experience day after day after day after day, those are where the permanent changes come from. And one of the things that happens with those permanent changes is that it knocks the language out of you. You have this feeling, you have this experience, and it's like you just move your lips, like, you know, what is that? It's a very isolating kind of trauma. You want to forget it. I mean, the subconscious automatically suppresses it. It's just too painful to deal with. And so to heal from trauma, they say you have to do two things that verge on the impossible. Dr. Judith Herman, a psychiatrist, who's one of the foremost authorities on the subject, says that to heal from trauma, you have to witness and testify. And that means you have to go back and look at the event that happened, and you don't want to do that. And you are contending with your own brain. Your own brain is trying to suppress those very, very powerful and disruptive memories. That's the first thing you have to do. You have to go look at those events. And then you have to testify. You have to talk about it. And what that does is it converts the experience from the status of like a flashback. And in a flashback, the difference between a flashback and a memory is that if a flashback is an experience of an event that happened as though it's happening again, again and again and again. When I hit the deer, I had a flashback. It brought back a mission in which I was shot down. And in way less than a second, that whole mission, I mean, I remembered everything. It was like I was there. Again, the tracers were coming up. I could hear the radio transmissions in my headset and so forth. When you do what Dr. Herman recommends, you remember that. Okay, I was shot down over the village of Fu Wadong about 2 o'clock in the morning, and it happened in 1968. It's not happening now. Mm-hmm. Happened then. And then you have to talk about it to somebody. And that's why I did that talk at the Unitarian Church. Mm-hmm. Hardest thing I ever did in my life. The whole time I was writing that sermon, I just thought I'd much rather be in a firefight. It'd be so much easier if somebody was just shooting at me and I could just shoot back. That's what you have to do for the healing. The other thing that has to happen is that the public has to be open to that. It would be wonderful, Taylor, if the school districts of America said, you know what, we've got a moral duty to our students to educate them. We're in the business of teaching them to prepare them for life. We have a moral duty to teach them about the reality of PTSD. They're not doing that. Mm-hmm. Very controversial. That idea is very controversial. Instead, the recruiters come on campus mm-hmm. and they paint a very seductive, attractive portrait. They tell a lie, mm-hmm. an attractive lie. They seduce our young people into an experience that's going to have, that will devastate them, and will affect them for the rest of their lives. Well, you'll know things are changing in America the minute the parents of America say, school boards, let's have a conversation about who works for who here. You work for us. We're paying you to educate our kids. We want you to start teaching our kids the truth about what going to war means.
Yeah, that would be... I remember seeing that. I mean, it was so... it's pretty bizarre, you know, to be in high school, to know next to nothing about life or the world, you know, and particularly, you know, having gone through school. I mean, my entire school career was during the so-called war on terror. You know, the majority of my life now has been spent during that period in history, which is a bizarre one, to say the least, you know, and to not ever quite get there in discussions in the formal learning process, to not talk about what's happening currently, and then to have that coupled with attractive lies, as you said. You know, I've seen it in people I know have this disastrous effect that it's, you know, it's too late to undo it. So I think you're right about getting proactive and stopping it from happening. At the very least, stop inviting these institutions who we know what their job is, you know, to do into kids' heads. So,
yeah.
And we only have a few minutes left, surprisingly. An hour always just kind of flies by. What else would you like people to know, to understand? Are there resources that you want to share with folks who have been listening the last hour?
You know, there are a couple of resources I'll mention. I attended the Saratoga Warhorse Equine Therapy, PTSD Equine Therapy program in New York. And that's a wonderful program. It's a good first step. It's not definitive. It's not a pill that'll change everything, but it's a wonderful first step. And you can just, you know, Google Saratoga Warhorse, go online. And if you have PTSD or you know somebody who has PTSD, take a look at that program. Mm-hmm. They will fly you back, no cost to you, put you up at a really nice hotel room and give you a wonderful experience. There's an organization here in Spokane that I'm volunteering with, Free Rein Therapeutic Stable. They have a military horsemanship program that they do in conjunction with the Wounded Warrior program. Wonderful program, wonderful people. So there are two resources. I would recommend the Spokane Vet Center. If you're struggling with PTSD, if you know somebody who has PTSD, get in touch with those folks. It's a really good organization, and there's help available there.
Good. And is there just any final, I don't know, Valentine's Day or otherwise, a message to people you want to close with?
You know, I am experiencing a miraculous change in myself and my work with PTSD. It's really, really hard. It's scary. It's lonely a lot of the time. But when you work at it, you experience changes inside yourself. And for me, they're analogous to like doing physical exercise just right, like not overdoing it so that you hurt yourself, but tasking yourself so that you stretch yourself. The first thing you know is you are experiencing a strength that you didn't know you were capable of. So I'm experiencing that now myself. I guess the message that I would end with, Taylor, is that for all these years since Vietnam, I thought a part of me died, and it did. A part of me died. A part of you dies when you go to war. And it felt like a permanent loss to me, and it felt like an absolute sadness. And I've had this grief that I'll never make it home again. I can't go home again. What I realize now is that I don't want to return to the home that sent me to war. I want to find another home. And we do that by doing the kind of thing that we're doing right now.
Great. I sure hope so. It's good. Well, thank you so much for talking with me. I'm glad we finally got to do this. And yeah, I hope some people listening will kind of launch their own journey based on that. So
thank you for having me, Taylor.
Yeah, thank you.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Yeah, you too.
Thank you.
We can have a non-commercial Valentine's Day. Very good. Thank you for listening out there. And you've been listening to Praxis on KYRS. You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.